Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Ask Katie Anything. I'm your host, licensed marriage and family therapist, Katie Morton. I'm so glad that you're here. In today's episode, we are going to talk about how we can get past the feeling that our relationship with our therapist is quote unquote fake. I'm also going to talk about how we can support our students if we're a teacher or work in a school system without being triggered ourselves, and how to know if we are re-traumatizing ourselves. Then I'm going to get into how to know if we ourselves are a narcissist, what it means to actually process our emotions, and what we can do if we feel ashamed of our life. Without further ado, let's jump right in. Question number one says, "Hi, Katie. How do I get past the feeling that the relationship with my therapist is fake? I've heard you say that you should feel validated and seen by your therapist, but I can't get past the fact that the only reason she's talking to me is because I'm paying her. Maybe this is my child of emotional neglect talking. We'll talk about that. But the idea that anyone is interested in helping me is very alien. But that doesn't change the fact that my therapist isn't my friend, never will be, and wouldn't choose to talk to me if I didn't hand over a lot of money. What am I missing? I do not understand why I should think that this person cares for me or sees me. I know I emotionally need the sessions, but I don't understand how I should feel about this." Okay, now there's an add-on to this, but let's just jump right in. Now, the biggest piece here is the fact that it's going to be hard for you to believe that anybody wants to hear you, wants to see you, wants to spend time with you because of your emotional neglect in childhood. But when it comes to a therapist, sure, it's a job and we show up and we get paid to listen and talk to you. But you have to think of all the work that we do to become a therapist and all the work in between sessions that we do. And the reason I bring that up is because we don't get into being a therapist to make a lot of money. Now, just hear me out. I got a lot of pushback on this before, but I can run you through what therapists make, and it's not a lot. Unless, I mean, I guess if they charge like $500 an hour or something crazy, but we have to pay for our office space with it, like, which if we're in a city can be like thousands and thousands of dollars, like $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 a month. We have to have liability insurance, meaning if someone tries to sue us or take our license, we have insurance for that. We also usually have to pay a biller or have some kind of billing system, which costs at the low end, like $1,000 a year. At the high end, it's a person's salary. And then we have to pay for all our own other stuff, right? Like any overhead when it comes to like having a copier, having paper, having water. Cause I have like, we had this like Mountain Spring water system and Keurigs, all the stuff in the office we have to pay for. We also have to pay for the continuing education units, which cost, I mean, thousands of dollars every year. And we have to do 36 every 2 years and our license. And I'm not saying this to like, oh, feel bad for me. I'm saying this to let you know that the average therapist, when I was in school, now that's been a long time ago. So I was in school in like 2008, 2009, the average therapist made $55,000 a year. And I'm just saying that because I think when I was in practice, I don't even think I made that much. I didn't do it full time. I worked in the hospital system, you know, a couple days a week, and then did private practice a couple days a week. But I just want you to know that at the end of the day, I know it feels like, oh, they're in it for the money. There's not that much money. We get into it because we care about people. And I have to be truthful personally. The reason that I got into it is because it's fulfilling. I love to see my patients doing well. I love to see the progress. And the fact that everybody's so different, it's an ever-changing and evolving job, which is cool because I would get super bored with anything else I did. And so just keep that in mind. I know that that doesn't change how you feel. I'm just kind of giving a little context to the the belief that like, oh, a therapist only talks to me because I pay them. I mean, yes, it's a job. It's like your person who cuts your hair only cuts your hair because you pay them, and you only get to take the groceries out of a store because you pay for them. But that doesn't mean that, you know, the person who cuts your hair hates doing it and wouldn't show up if you weren't paying. Like, it's a weird thing to think about because you can apply that to almost everything in life, I guess, other than like actual friendships, which the reason the therapist cannot be our friend is because then there's no boundaries, like therapeutic boundaries, meaning that you know too much about your therapist, therefore you may not feel safe to share something with them. For example, if we ever had a friend who we knew didn't like our boyfriend or girlfriend or whoever we were dating, therefore, if we decided to get back with that person or decided to date somebody that we knew they didn't like, we're not going to tell them. Or we won't tell them for a little bit longer because we're like, oh, I know you don't like them, right? If we know too much about a therapist, we won't share the things that we are afraid they won't like or don't agree with. And that's why we don't know as much about them, if anything, okay? So I just wanted to give some context to that. But in this specific case, the emotional neglect you sustained as a child makes it hard for you to ever trust people, rightfully so, and feel like you yourself are valuable enough for them to show up. There's clearly some kind of shame story going on here. And so my encouragement for you is to let your therapist know that you're feeling like this and that you believe it's coming out of your emotional neglect in childhood and shame thoughts. Because the fact that you think she's only going to show up because you're paying her, and you said that, you know, the idea that anyone's interested in helping me is very alien, it's uncomfortable. And I have to be honest here, if we're uncomfortable in therapy, that's actually a good thing. And we need to bring it up with our therapist and let them know this is coming up, because this gives your therapist a path forward. Whenever a patient of mine comes in and they're like, you know what, I just find myself shutting down, I don't know what's happening, I keep dissociating, that gives me a path forward. I'm like, oh, we need more resourcing, we need more grounding techniques, maybe I'm going too fast. Like, all of that's helpful information. And so is this, because it's not about the fact that you need to think this person cares for you or sees you. That's not what it is. I believe your goal in therapy is instead for you to believe that you're worth seeing, that you're worth being cared for. That's going to be where the healing starts. And we can work this out in therapy. We can talk about why we don't believe that. We can talk about relationships in our real life outside of therapy. And if we run into this again, because the thing about therapy that's interesting is that it's often indicative of other things going on. So if we're having an issue in therapy, we think the relationship with our therapist is fake. I would be curious if you find yourself thinking that other people in your life don't want to show up for you or don't want to really spend time with you or that you're not worthy of their care. Have we thought about that in romantic relationships or friendships before? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. That's where I would dig in. But let your therapist know, and then we can move forward from there. Now, there was a comment on this that I'm exactly the same. I tell my therapist on a regular basis that our relationship is fake and that I'm expecting him to let me down. He will have to work hard to earn my trust. I think part of me does this to test him. Mm-hmm. Will he eventually cave and abandon me like everyone else? We're like self-fulfilling prophecy there. How long will it take? How far can I push him before he breaks? Interesting boundary testing. I'm expecting him to leave, abandon me, just like everyone else. I also realize that this is purely a professional relationship, and I'm not expecting him to be my friend outside of our sessions. I wish I could let my guard down, but I have to guard my heart first and foremost. How do I help get past this? How? Please help. Now, this is very similar to the answer that I already gave, but the piece here that I want to at least explain or highlight is that this sounds a little attachment, maybe BPD related. The fact that you're like, just like everyone else, he's going to leave me. How far can I push him? My borderline personality disorder patients, my patients with BPD do this a lot. This like testing boundaries. How far can I push you? How much can I do until I have pushed you too far that you abandon me, which is like what I thought was going to happen, which then just reiterates the fact that everyone's going to abandon me, which is like this huge piece of my diagnosis, right? This intense fear of real or imagined abandonment. Because here it's actually imagined, but it still feels very real, right? That's why they say real or imagined. You're assuming that he's going to leave. And so you're pushing all these ways to try to get him to, even though you don't really want him to, it's very uncomfortable, right? And so part of me thinks that obviously the answer that I gave to the first piece is going to apply here too. Now, the first answer that I gave would still apply here. However, I think there's a piece in here of for like DBT or dialectical behavior therapy or some other kind of modalities that work for BPD. Any kind of attachment-based work could be really beneficial because what's happening in this case. So the first part of the question is kind of, sorry guys, I've got something in my eyeball. The first part of the question is definitely more in the trauma response, childhood emotional neglect space. We can almost see that direct correlation, those shame thoughts. In this bottom piece, it's very much about fear of abandonment. And the fact that we don't trust anybody, everybody's gonna leave us, you're just gonna let me down. It's this disbelief for that anybody would ever wanna be there for us, support us, and show up and care. And so while these can both be potentially related in some way, maybe our BPD comes from trauma that comes from, you know, specifically childhood emotional neglect. But I believe that the abandonment thing is an important thing to mention. I have an attachment workshop on my website at katiemorton.com that you might find beneficial as well. But obviously you've let them know this is happening, but we might mention, say, hey, I wouldn't mind doing some work on attachment or learning some DBT skills because I feel very dysregulated. And that causes me to like push these boundaries because that's really what's happening. It's not that you want him to leave. It's honestly not even that you don't trust him. It's the fear that if you do, then you're going to be abandoned. And that potential for abandonment is so dysregulating that we can't even participate. And so my goal, if I was working with you, would be to find some ways to regulate your system because that's where DBT comes in. Tons of mindfulness and emotion regulation skills. I would do those heavy up front before we get into, you know, things like interpersonal effectiveness and other pieces of DBT. But that's where I would go because it's not about you need to let your guard down. Let's not try to quote unquote fix this or get the answer. Let's instead address the fact that we're so afraid of being abandoned and that we don't know how to regulate. So anybody who we ever think that we could possibly trust immediately becomes a threat. Because we're like, oh my God, they could abandon us. And so we need to navigate that first before we go into, hey, how do I open up with my therapist? How do I trust them? How do I start leaning into this? How do I do that? We can't do that if we're dysregulated. So that's kind of where we have to start with that. Okay, now let's move on to question number two. This question says, hey, Katie, I work at a school as a teacher and I also work for the before and after programs. I do a lot of work at the school. I work with a lot of different types of students. When I was a little kid, I had a lot of trauma. When any kid comes to school with a bruise, I think the worst. Sometimes it's hard for me to see the kiddos cry. Some of the kids come from rough backgrounds and they tell me things like no one loves me or no one cares about me. And I try my best to let them know I care without crossing the student-teacher boundaries. When I get home, I just cry because I feel so little all over again because I know how they feel. My question is, how do I show my students that I care without emotionally hurting myself or triggering myself? Thank you so much for all that you do. Of course, the piece here is more about your personal work. Now, I don't know if you're in therapy. If you're not, I can't encourage you enough to start because I think that you're going to have to do some inner child work. I also have an inner child workshop if you want to get started that way. It's available on my website, katiemorton.com. But until we kind of process or better navigate our own situation, our own past, our own experiences, our own feelings, we're not going to be able to show up in a real way for them without essentially lighting ourselves on fire to keep them warm. And the reason for that is because we haven't fully come to grips with what happened to us. And so any reminder of that is like, ooh, it's almost like we're all frayed wires and their wire touches ours and it sends that shock, right? And until we heal and cover that end wire up, I'm not an electrician, but you know, they put those little like end caps on them to protect them so you don't get shocked by them. Until we do the work in therapy, get those end caps on those wires, whenever we come into contact with someone who reminds us that all of our trauma, it's like shock waves, right? Because we're too raw, we're too exposed. And I don't mean that to say that like we have to shut it down and stuff it down. Rather, we need to find a therapist. We need to start processing our own so that when we encounter other people, we're not brought back to that little us as a child who was super scared and traumatized, right? And I know that's going to take some work. And there are some tools we can use, like things like stepping away when you start to feel overwhelmed, doing body shakes, splashing cold water on our faces, taking breaks. I know teachers work really hard and you work really long hours. Like maybe we're doing a little bit too much. Maybe we're overwhelmed and so our resilience is down, which can also make us more vulnerable to being triggered and dysregulated. Those are all the places that I would try to work, because it's really about us becoming healed in our own selves, feeling safe in our person as we are, or at least neutral, so much so that we can be there for someone else, watching them, you know, tell us something that is similar to our experience, but because we work through it, it has no emotional charge. And we're able to look them in the eye and say, I'm so sorry that happened. And then maybe offer a resource. I think keeping up those boundaries is really important, but that doesn't mean we can't say, you know, I don't know, Miss Cleveland is the student counselor, is the counselor, if you want me to set you up an appointment, I'm happy to help make that happen. You know, we can offer some support. And I think sometimes in also doing that, offering some actual tangible support, we can be almost reparenting or doing our own inner child work too, like getting to be that for someone else, the thing that we wish someone had done for us, that can be healing too. I've had a lot of patients feel that and get some kind of, it's not further along in their processing, but they are able to find some relief in that, in doing that. And so maybe that could be a piece for you as well. But it's really going to come down to you getting the support you need to process your own past trauma. Because unfortunately, when our resilience is low, we're going to be more easily triggered, period. And until we build that up, you know, we're going to be super sensitive and you're just going to want to come home and cry. And so if we're not in therapy right now, let's start looking into that. Let's start finding someone like immediately. And in the meantime, we can look into an inner child workshop I've got. We can start looking into kind of calming or grounding techniques, things like the body shakes and ice water in our face, or taking a little break and a breather, doing meditation apps. There's any number of things, just depending on what works for you. But try to find some things to calm your nervous system down, help you feel okay and not as dysregulated. Those will all help too. And there's another comment. It said, I'm also a teacher and I have the same issue. I sometimes feel disconnected from my students and definitely my teammates. This year seems especially rough. I have multiple students with many social emotional needs, some that mirror my struggles in real life. I have made more calls to the child abuse line this year than in previous years. Ooh, aren't those the worst? I hate having to do that. How do I not get triggered when I make those calls? I always have to leave time to decompress after calling. I'm glad that you do, and it's okay to have that time. How do I turn off my brain at the end of the day? We're going to have a ritual or routine. Leaving time to decompress after doing one of those calls is fine. I encourage you to keep that time. But we need to find some ways to kind of get that out of our system, whether that's some breathing exercises, the body shakes, the double deep breaths where we go all the way full, breathe again at the end, you know, double fill. Any of the things that can help, let's do those things. And then have a ritual for how you finish work. I'll give an example of one that I had, and then give some ideas of what you had. So when I used to work in my private practice, it was like 2 blocks from our apartment. So I would walk like down and up to my office. And after my last session, I would finish all my notes. I would file them away. I would lock up my filing cabinet. You have to get the office ready to be closed down, you know, make sure the blinds are like open for the plants in the morning, make sure this is shut, make sure that's this way, blah, blah, blah. Wash the dishes, yada, yada, shut down the office. And I would do them in this order. And it sounds weird, but it's kind of helpful to have a ritual or routine. Do things in the specific order. Check that nobody else is in the office. Lock the door. Shut it. Lock the waiting room door. Shut it. And then I'd walk out. And because I listened to people all day, I didn't want to talk to anybody. I never made any calls. And I would walk down. We had this new restaurant on the corner. And I would stop in there and either get an appetizer or a glass of wine or both. And I would just sit and decompress for a little bit. And then I'd walk the rest of the way home. Not that it was a long walk, but I just needed like this little ritual of things that I could do to help me decompress. A lot of people get in their cars and drive, and that's a beautiful time to have a certain ritual or routine. Do we have a podcast we put on? Do we sit in silence? What do we do? What are the things that we do to leave work at work and move on to home life? Especially if we work at home, we should have an even more intense ritual around that. But I know in this case, you're going to a school. So let's put together a ritual. Does that mean that we, you know, clean off our desk and we put these things away and then we shut our computer and then we put everything together, we get our bag, we fill up our water at the water tank, we put the lid back on, we get in our car, we listen to a certain podcast and we drive home, or we turn everything off and sit in silence. I don't know, whatever you need. But let's have a routine. Let's get in that ritual, because I do believe that we need that time to leave work at work and to enter regular life. And then even when you get home, I actually encourage you to change your clothes into like house clothes, like immediately. I know that sounds kind of weird and some people don't like to do that. Try it out, because it's almost like Mr. Rogers when he like takes off his shoes and takes off a sweater. There's a nice feeling to like, I was work, Katie, and now I'm home, Katie. And having a difference between those two can be really, really helpful when it comes to like turning your brain off at the end of the day, not taking work home with you, not feeling overwhelmed all the time. Okay, give those things a try and then keep me posted, okay? Let's move on to question number three. This question says, Katie, how do I know if I'm re-traumatizing myself? This is a great question. And the way that we know if we're re-traumatizing ourselves is if we feel all the trauma responses all the time, meaning that when we're re-traumatizing ourselves, it's gonna come up. We're gonna feel like really dysregulated. We'll probably dissociate or have a panic attack. We could feel really sweaty, almost like we're gonna pass out. We'll feel, again, essentially the way that we felt before. Like, let's say we've had flashbacks in the past and that makes us feel some kind of way. I know everybody's experience is different, but let's say I feel really scared and really vulnerable and I wanna run, but I can't. So that same feeling is going to be happening. We're going to have the trauma responses all over again, and there's no end in sight. That's how we know that re-traumatizing is happening, is we have a trauma response because we're being traumatized. It just so happens we've been traumatized before. And so if you fear for your own safety or life or the life and safety of someone that you know and love, it's happening again. And the reason this happens in therapy, unfortunately, is if a therapist doesn't recognize the signs and goes too much too fast, and we don't have any way of telling them like, hey, whoa, 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 we're already like dissociated or, you know, have gone into our own kind of like fight, flight, freeze, whatever, we're maybe having a panic attack and they don't know. That's why that can happen. And so just notice, because it's not that when we do the work, when it comes to reprocessing, I don't even know if that's, you know, what's happening here, but it sounds like it said to yourself. So if you're putting yourself in positions that cause these symptoms to come up more strongly, let's not do that. Let's first build on our resources and our coping skills, meaning that if we're going to start processing this, right, in therapy, let's say we're going to start processing this, we need to first lay a good foundation of ways to calm our system down so that as we work through it or as we talk about it or do any of our own, even personal work on our own, I don't want you to think that it's not going to be dysregulating. I don't want you to think it's going to be easy peasy lemon squeezy. We will get dysregulated, but we shouldn't feel like it pushes us into a dissociative state, a panic attack, fight, flight, freeze. We should feel, ooh, I feel a little overwhelmed. I'm going to take a break. I'm going to, you know, splash my face with cold water. I'm going to go for a walk. I'm going to call a friend. I'm going to do a body shake. I'm going to do whatever, right? We can feel dysregulated, but not to the point of being traumatized. We shouldn't fear for our safety. We shouldn't go into fight flight. And I know that's kind of hard. And it's going to be this new muscle as we build, like little by little, getting a little bit more activated and then calming down. That's normal. That's okay. Take your time with it. But you'll know that you're re-traumatizing yourself if you feel like the trauma is happening again, if you're doing things to yourself, if you are traumatized again, fearing for your own life or safety or the life and safety of someone else. So if you're engaging in situations or in relationships that are causing those same symptoms to come up, I encourage you to rethink those relationships and situations, okay? Now, there was an add-on. It said, my eating disorder was related to trauma. I worked and thought I did overcome the problem with eating. When my eating disorder suddenly came back, I wondered if this could be a sign of being re-traumatized, because there were things that felt similar, like my traumatic experiences, even though it was completely different experiences and much more little. The feeling was the same. Okay. Truth be told here, eating disorders are coping skills. And so the fact that it came back means that something's going on that you don't know how to cope with. And that could be a trauma. We could be re-traumatized. Or it could be the fact that maybe something is happening in our life that feels out of control and we try to take control back with our eating disorder. Or maybe we're feeling intense, you know, symptoms of depression or anxiety. And therefore we turn to our eating disorder to help us kind of cope or numb out. Or if we're doing the work on our trauma, our eating disorder can get exacerbated and come back, because again, its whole goal is to kind of help us numb out from it, right? And so even in the work of trying to make the trauma go away or the effects of the trauma go away, we can be triggered. and that can make our eating disorder stronger. So it can come from a lot of different places. I guess you'd have to tell me what's going on and if the things that are going on are re-traumatizing. Like if you feel like your therapist is going too fast, if you feel like you are in situations in your life and in relationships that are very harmful and you fear for your safety. Like, you know, you have to let me know what's going on, but that's really what my thoughts are about that specifically, okay? Let's move on to question number four. This question says, Katie, how do I know if I am a narcissist? And what is real empathy? Okay, if we even ask, if we're even worried, if we think being a narcissist is bad and we're concerned that we might be one, chances are you're not. Because narcissists don't think anything is wrong with them. We have to remember the key pieces of being a narcissist are that we don't feel very good about ourselves, but we even have a tough time admitting that to ourselves. And we put up this big fake facade of being strong and being important and everybody, you know, needs to kowtow to us and we're always correct about everything. Like that's where narcissism kind of comes from. And we manipulate people to get what we want because we don't actually feel for anybody else. Moving into the second piece of your question, like what is real empathy? Empathy itself is the ability to feel for someone else. If you can imagine what it's like to be in someone else's shoes, then you are able to have empathy. And that's why it's so hard for those of us who aren't narcissists or sociopaths to understand is that they don't have that. They don't have empathy. It's why they can't apologize. They don't feel bad. They can't imagine what you're experiencing. Their thought is, get over it. I'm more important. Isn't our relationship more important to you? How dare you? Because they can't imagine that what they said or did was hurtful. They don't even know what it's like to be hurt because they don't allow themselves to feel that. And so for those of us who aren't in that space, don't have any of those, you know, kind of cluster B type mental illnesses, it's hard for us to imagine not having empathy because it just seems like it's like a part of who we are, right? I can't imagine not feeling bad for somebody or watching something bad happen, being like, oh, that must be so hard. Or even being excited, be like, go get it, good job. And being excited for someone, that's all empathy. It's the ability to meet someone in their own emotional state, to be able to understand it, to be able to identify it. If you asked a narcissist to explain what it might have felt like for someone else to go through something, they'd have a really tough time. They'd probably tell you their own story because they can only see things like that through their own lens. And so that's just a little bit about empathy and narcissism. And I know it's really hard to imagine not having it, but those people do not. Again, that's why they lie, manipulate, and don't apologize. And they leave a ton of pain and trauma in their wake because of that. Okay, let's move on to question number five. I also have a video, Am I a Narcissist? You can look it up on YouTube, just Am I a Narcissist, Katie Morton, it'll come up. I think I'm wearing a pink shirt and it's got like white block letters on the thumbnail. I feel like I saw it the other day. So you can watch that if you wanna know more. Question number five says, Hi Katie, how are you? I'm doing well, thanks for asking. Says, this is a repost from last week. I hope that's okay. I left that in because you can continue to repost until your question gets answered. There's nothing wrong with that. Just know that if I heart your comment or question, that I am going to answer it. I'm always about 2 weeks ahead, just in case I get sick or I'm traveling, about 2 weeks ahead. So if I have hearted your question, you're like, I haven't heard my answer, that's because I'm 2 weeks ahead, okay? And I know I put that when I asked for the questions, but just in case nobody read that, now you know. This question says, I have a question about processing emotions, feeling them and moving through them. How much is too much and how much is not enough? And mainly, how does this change when it comes to processing something big like grief? I lost two people very close to me recently. I'm so sorry. And I always try to stuff down emotions and don't want to feel them. So I'm trying really hard to notice and feel them with this because I know it's healthy and I need to. You're correct. Sometimes it's constant and it's way too much for me to handle. And sometimes it's nothing. What's a healthy amount of emotion? Now, it's a great question. And I wish there was like a 20 minutes, like a timed amount, like feel your emotions for X amount. The truth about emotions is that ideally, when we feel them come up, so let's say I'm out with friends and I suddenly feel this wave of sadness. I miss my grandma or something, right? And I'm so sorry for your loss. I've lost a lot of people in my life too, and it's very heavy. But let's say I feel this wave of grief. Ugh. In an ideal world, in that moment, I would let myself cry for a period of time, Now, I always tell my patients, you will cry it out. Like, has anybody ever just cried all night? Like, you cry for a long time. You do cry it out. You essentially either become, number one, too exhausted by the crying. Sorry, I hit my microphone there. But you either become too exhausted by the crying that you fall asleep, or you just become kind of done with it. And that's just one example. I know that's using crying, like sadness, as this example. But for the grief, because you're talking about that, you kind of run out of it. And that's how emotions are. They're like waves that we have to ride. And I will tell you, especially when it comes to grief, that the waves come and go at very inopportune times often, and they go away and they come back and they go away. It's not that we have to let ourselves wallow in it. That's where I always caution my patients. I'm like, I don't want you spending more, and this is like being very generous, more than an hour, like feeling the emotion, because that's when I believe it becomes kind of like more of a rumination or a wallowing. And that doesn't actually help us. That's impeding our life. Like, we're putting so many other things on hold so that we can just dive deep into this. And I don't believe we need to do that. I believe we need to, you know, acknowledge what it is. Like, what I'm feeling right now is grief and sadness and some kind of anger, right? A feelings wheel can help here. And it just feels very overwhelming. I just want you just to feel it happen. You can feel it kind of building in your body. I feel like I need to cry. And then we allow ourselves to cry. And it could last for a minute. It could last for 5 minutes. Just notice if there's any additional tension that comes up in your body when you're finished. Because once we finish crying or screaming or whatever, we shouldn't feel any residual tension. We should almost feel like, exhausted. And I'm not saying that's going to happen each and every time, but if you still feel tense, like for me, I feel it in my throat, and I feel it in my stomach. And those are indications that I have not let myself process, that I've stuffed it down. I like let it rise, and it's almost like my eye like sucks the tear back in. It's like, not today, right? That's when I know I'm stuffing it down. So be curious about your own process, what it feels like in your body. Are you able to let yourself cry a little bit and then move on? Knowing that if you have to cry again in a couple hours or in the next day, you can do that too. The grief is heavy. Grief is weird. It definitely is in waves. It comes and goes, and it doesn't go in these stages of grief. There are kind of pieces of, I'd argue that they're not so much like stages in order. They're just the way that grief kind of shows up is that, you know, you can kind of bargain, which I think bargaining happens for often on a lot longer. You can be angry. I'm still kind of angry sometimes about my dad not being here. You know, get into depression, which I feel like for me happened probably like 6 months after my dad passed and then kind of faded. And, you know, and then they're like, and then you're fine. It's not really like that. And I know I'm missing a few in there. I'm not going through all the steps or stages, but I'm just bringing that up to say that you'll go in any order, however you feel. And I don't want you thinking that you need to move right through it, right? I want you to feel like it can happen. It'll come in a wave. I can allow my body to release that. I can allow my brain to think about these things and feel sadness. That's okay. There aren't bad emotions. I know, unfortunately, people talk about things that way. It's not true. Emotions are helpful. Emotions tell us that something's going on. They aren't good and bad. They're all fine. They're all helpful. They're all good. They're indicators of what's happening in our life and indicators that maybe we need to slow down. Grief is really heavy, like I said, and so you might need to give yourself a little bit of a break to feel it and to rest, because nobody talks about how exhausting it is. So maybe I'll be the first, you know? I think that's really it. I just want to make sure I'm answering all your questions. Too much is if we're wallowing and we can't get out of it and we can't do, and I mean, grief aside, when it comes to processing emotions, if you are spending so much time processing that you can't do what you need to every day, that's a problem. That's too much. And not enough is when we still feel the tension in our bodies and like we're swallowing it down, and it makes it stronger. It's like the more we suppress our emotions, actually the stronger they feel, because I mean, they feel bigger. We also have stuffed them down, so they potentially could have gotten bigger. But you know, that does, if we start to feel them more and more and more intensely, and we're really really just tense and uncomfortable, that's an example of it not being enough. Or if we still feel like we need to cry, but we like stuff it, you know, we're like, I don't have time. Get it together, right? If we feel that way, that means it's not enough. And then how does it change when it comes to processing something like grief? Grief just takes, I think, longer, and it's going to come and go over the course of a couple years at least, if not more. I mean, I would argue grief kind of hangs around. And I saw this thing online that really spoke to me. It was like, we often think that grief goes away and gets smaller with time. But the truth is that our life just gets bigger and keeps growing around it. And that is very true. I feel that in my soul, that like grief doesn't go away. It doesn't get smaller, but your life continues on and it grows around it. And it makes space for that grief, knowing that that's a kind of a hole where love used to be. And there's times when I open up and I look into that little grief hole and I'm sad, but then my life is big enough that I can move out of it and get back into my life. And then I can peek back in when I need to, when I'm missing someone and feeling sad that they're not here. And so don't think that grief is like an emotion that we just feel and it goes away. I feel like grief is something that we kind of learn to live with. And that's all the more reason for us to get to know it, to allow for it, and to give ourselves permission to grieve, because, you know, it's just so heavy. Okay, there was a comment on this. I have to move on. The last question says, sorry, what is a healthy amount of emotion? Any amount is healthy. I know we're like societally bred to believe that you're too emotional. No, emotions are healthy and happy and regular. They're supposed to happen each and every day, all the time. It will feel like too much when we don't allow them to exist. Again, in the suppression of the emotion, it gets bigger and stronger. So there's a healthy amount of emotion is all emotion. I would say the thing that you might be tying this to is our expression of emotion, meaning that if I'm like lashing out at somebody and my anger is like out of control, then we want to be curious about that. And if it's because we've been suppressing it, is there some deeper issue going on? Am I unhappy in X, Y, or Z way, right? We have to kind of dig into that because it could be affecting the rest of our life and our relationships. But the emotions itself are not bad or good. They're just helpful information and part of what it means to be a human. There's a comment on this that says, with grief, would the process be different if it's a sudden loss like suicide or an accident, as opposed to a long-term illness or even old age? Everyone's grieving process is different, but in my experience and like personal and even what I've talked with people in our community about, there's a little bit of a difference here in the experience of grief. When it's a long-term illness or even old age, we often start grieving before they're actually gone, right? Like we know they're getting older. It's really, really sad. Like let's say one of our pets has an illness and they're like 14 years old and the vet says, you know, they only have like a couple years maybe to live. We start to grieve then and there. Now, is it the same when they actually do pass away? No, that's still heavy and terrible, but we've started that grieving process. We've even entertained the idea that they might not be around forever, right? We get that opportunity when it comes to more of a long-term illness or old age. When it comes to suicide or an accident, it's a shock. And we don't have any time to do any of that like pre-grief. We don't have any time to maybe say what we want to say or spend the time with them we want to spend. It's jarring. And while both can be traumatizing, I would argue the likelihood of a sudden one being traumatizing is probably a little bit higher than it being slow. Again, I'm not trying to say one's greater or less than. They both feel terrible. None of them are good. Losing someone or losing a pet, losing an important piece of our life is very, very hard, right? But when it's something like, and suicide can be complicated. I actually have a video about losing someone to suicide. You can look it up because it's very specific. But when it's sudden or it's an accident, like, oh my God, this happened, I feel like there's more grief to happen on the back end where we probably have already started that process when it's more of a long-term or, you know, old age type of situation. Okay. Final question. Question number 6 says, hi, Katie, what can I do if I feel ashamed of my life? Ashamed of what happened to me, ashamed of how much it affects me today and how little the events really were. Oh, look at that judgment. I'm so desperate about everything that isn't working anymore and everything I would so deeply wish but can't do anymore. And the pressure from others that I should function again is immense. How can I come out of this being ashamed of my life? Oh, I feel that. To be honest, shame is a terrible, terrible feeling. I'm so sorry that you're experiencing this. I have a couple of thoughts about shame specifically, and then some things that I think you can do to start finding your way out, okay? Now, the opposite of shame is, Brené Brown states, is courage. It's like the antithesis, or vulnerability, I believe, is actually what her quote would be. She talks about courage being a part of that, like the courage to be vulnerable. But when we feel ashamed, the thing about it is that we don't feel like being vulnerable, right? It feels really uncomfortable, feels very scary. We're worried that we're going to be shamed, blamed, and traumatized again, potentially, if we open ourselves up to it. And so my thoughts or my tips are to start paying attention. The first piece, because it sounds like you shit talk yourself. You said how little the events really were. You're already judging what happened. Like, I don't know why I'm so affected by this. You're affected because you're affected. We don't get to choose our resilience level or the circumstances that are placed in our life or things that happen to us, right? We don't always get to pick that. Things happened. Your body responded as it did. And now we're struggling with probably, I'd assume, trauma, PTSD, and shame. Things happen to you and you have every right to feel the way that you feel. And so we're going to have to do some bridge statements. We're going to have to pay attention to how we talk to ourselves when it comes to this. Do we struggle to call it trauma or abuse? Do we struggle to say that what we have is PTSD? Is it hard to hear people talk about it like that? Let's pay attention to the story that we're telling ourselves about it, because I want you to challenge it. And remember, bridge statements aren't positive. They're just not as negative. So instead of saying like, it wasn't even that big of a deal. Jeez, blech. What if we said, you know, I don't really think it's that big of a deal, but my response was big. That's interesting. I know it's not positive, but it's less negative. And we have to slowly get ourselves there, shifting the language little by little. Maybe then, you know, before we know it, we're into the, I do admit that something bad happened. I didn't like how it felt. I don't like my reaction though. Again, not positive, but not nearly as negative. So let's start working on that. And a piece of that might even be just journaling every day and paying attention to it. I want you to imagine that I'm reading your journal with you and I'm like, be nice to yourself. Like I just keep saying, you're not, that's not very nice to you. Is that very kind? I don't think that's very compassionate. I want you to imagine that I'm challenging you to think in a different way about it. Okay? Because that's the reason that I'm bringing this up first is that if we keep telling ourselves these shame-filled stories, we'll keep feeling ashamed. And nothing will improve because our brain, whether we realize it or not, believes the story we tell it, especially if we keep telling it. It's like through repetition, it learns, right? It's adaptive, makes sense. But we don't want it to learn this. We don't want it to learn that the events were really little. That's not really true. But it believes it to be true because we've been telling it that for years. And so we have to start changing that conversation. And we can't do that if we don't at least acknowledge that the conversation we're having is hurtful and bad. It's abusive maybe to ourselves. So we have to start noticing. And journaling allows for a little bit of that vulnerability. Of course, it's just with me, myself, and I, right? Journaling is just between you and the paper. So that gives you an opportunity to at least start opening up a little bit, be a little bit honest, and see if that vulnerability starts to lessen the shame, even if it's like 1% less. And that is the start, because then we can move into looking for a therapist, starting to open up to them. If you're in therapy already, I would let them know you're struggling with this, you need help with it. I also love, I'm forgetting the name, but Brené Brown has some great books. I bet if you just get on Amazon and look up, you know, Vulnerability of Brené Brown, her books will come up. I want to say is it Out of the Wilderness? Let me look it up really quick because I want to give you one of the ones that I'm thinking. Oh, Braving the Wilderness. Yes, that's the one that I love. And I think that one could be incredibly, incredibly helpful for you to kind of feel less ashamed, embarrassed, bad about the situation. It can help you. There's also Daring Greatly, which people really liked. And that's about like vulnerability itself. So maybe Daring Greatly might be, I really like Braving the Wilderness, but maybe Daring Greatly would fit better. But those are some great books. That's her specialty. I might dig into those and get into therapy and it will really help. You can come out of this. We have to stop telling ourselves that same story over and over because it's not true. Okay. Thank you all so much for listening and watching. Thank you for sharing this podcast. Thank you for sending in your questions. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your week. Do your homework, and I'll see you next time.